loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, Donald Trump has selected appeals court judge Brett Kavanaugh to be his nominee to the Supreme Court. We'll dig into what his record is, what this means for the court, and what this means for the rest of us as the court gets more and more conservative. And then we continue our weekly series every Tuesday called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with financial policy analyst Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the Trump administration announced last night that it would be unable to comply with a court order directing it to reunify all migrant children under the age of five who were separated from their families at the border. A Justice Department spokesman said the administration may be able to unify 54 of the 102 children by today. Also, a court ruled against a Trump policy of long-term detention for immigrants. Next, President Trump arrives in Brussels today to attend the annual NATO summit. But instead of unity, European leaders expect Trump to berate them for not spending enough money on defense. And those European allies are afraid that Trump will threaten to withdraw U.S. troops from Europe if they don't spend more. Then U.S. Ambassador to Germany Rick Grenell yesterday urged Berlin to block Iran's request to withdraw $350 million of its own money from German banks and send it to Iran before sanctions take effect. Grenell came under fire a month ago after he said that he was seeking to boost anti-establishment parties around Europe. Many German politicians have called for him to be expelled from the country. And then President Trump today pardoned two ranchers from southeastern Oregon who were sentenced to serve prison time on two separate occasions for setting brush fires to clear public lands. The return to prison of father and son Dwight and Steve Hammond sparked the 41-day occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in early 2016, in which a protester was killed and an FBI agent was charged with lying about that shooting. And finally, Mark Zuckerberg is one of the wealthiest people on Earth, with a net worth of an estimated $74.2 billion. But he and his company have come under increasing fire for gross violations of user privacy. Should Zuckerberg resign as the head of Facebook? And in other headlines, the NFL Players Union filed a formal complaint today protesting the league's new rule requiring players to stand for the national anthem. The union said in a statement, quote, "This new policy, imposed by the NFL's governing body without consultation with the NFL Players Association, is inconsistent with the collective bargaining agreement," unquote. Athletes have been kneeling and engaging in other forms of protest during the national anthem to protest racism and police brutality. French President Emmanuel Macron gave a major address at the Palace of Versailles last night, discussing the crisis in the European Union defending his government's economic policies. Macron, who has been criticized for his pro-rich policies, came under fire for choosing a venue associated with the deposed French monarchy. Former left-wing presidential contender Jean-Luc Mélenchon remarked, quote, "We are convoked to admire the splendor of Macron the First," unquote. A suicide bomber struck the Afghan city of Jalalabad, killing at least 10 and injuring 4. No group claimed responsibility for the attack, but the two main armed groups fighting are the Taliban and ISIS. The bombing comes the day after Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made a surprise visit to the country, raising hopes of peace negotiations. Former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn appeared in court today for the first time since December. His lawyer says he's eager to move forward through the sentencing phase and put this problem behind him. Since he pled guilty to making a false statement, sentencing has been postponed 3 times. Some analysts have noted that the delay could indicate that special counsel Robert Mueller continues to need Flynn's cooperation. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
First, we turn to the Supreme Court. President Trump yesterday named Federal Appeals Court Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court seat being vacated by retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy. Kavanaugh has solid conservative credentials, and the Democrats in the Senate are virtually united in their opposition to his appointment. We'll see about that. The keys to his elevation will be Democratic senators running for re-election in states that Trump won, and Republican senators Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Susan Collins of Maine. What does this pick mean for those who have used the court as a tool for reform? We're joined from New York by Heidi Boghossian. Heidi is the executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute. She is the former executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. And we're joined from Atlanta, Georgia by Anoa Changa. Anoa is the Director of Public Advocacy and a Managing Editor of Progressive Army and the host of the show, The Way with Anoa. Anoa and Heidi, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anoa, what's your big takeaway? I'm going to ask you and Heidi the same question, then we're going to get into some of the details about what it might mean or might not mean for the Supreme Court. And we want to talk about the Supreme Court, too, as an institution. But let's start first with the big takeaway.
I think the big takeaway is just thinking about this nomination, right? I mean, looking in as it got narrowed down to the final three, and, you know, Kavanaugh started off his remarks last night talking about how Trump had considered and was the most considerate in his selection process. I mean, it just seems like every time he has a nominee or someone he's putting up for something, they have this very overboast way of highly praising him. I don't know if that's a part of the arrangement they all make before they sign on to his band of folks or not. But just thinking about, you know, Kavanaugh and some of the issues with him already being on record indicating that he's through his own support for the dissent in Roe v. Wade to his most recently to a young immigrant. I think she was 17, was in need of an abortion. And because she's a minor, still had to go through various legal channels to be able to get an abortion. And Kavanaugh took part in a dissent trying to deny that right and that process. So, I mean, he's also one of the other glaring issues I can think with Kavanaugh has been that he has written that the president should not basically the president should not be subjected to investigations, particularly those including those of a criminal nature. So there's a whole host of issues that many on the left or within liberal spaces are galvanizing around and really looking at addressing the fact that not only is this a, you know, a lifetime appointment, but when we're really looking at some of the most important wins, not just over the last 50 or 60 years, but really in the last 20 to 25 years, we're looking at the potential to have rolling back in terms of reproductive justice, voting rights, environmental issues, workers' rights, all types of things across the board. And this notion that folks will stay, you know, true to precedents, we just saw that, you know, thrown out the window with the Janus case. So that itself cannot be a saving grace in terms of whether or not we'll be kind of okay with this justice on the bench.
Heidi Boghossian, it was odd, actually, to hear people who consider themselves liberal lamenting the loss of Anthony Kennedy, because Kennedy has been the decider in this decidedly right-wing court and it's been a right-wing court for like 40 years. Anyway, will Kavanaugh's selection make a difference?
I think the Kavanaugh selection signals really a larger shift in this country in terms of the legal and political landscape shifting to the right. And what people who haven't been familiar with the group called the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies are starting to recognize is that since 1982, an organization that began at Yale University as really a small group of disaffected conservative law students has blossomed into an organization that now wields extraordinary influence over American law and politics. This is the group of conservative intellectuals who have monopolized the selection of federal judges. They've taken over the Justice Department in terms of who staffs it, and really they're controlling legal policy in our White House. They have about 60,000 conservative lawyers and law students. The Supreme Court justices on the right, Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, Alito, Gorsuch, are either current or former members. Every federal judge appointed during the two Bush presidencies was either a society member or approved by its members, as were the nominees for the Supreme Court vacancy. And we have chapters of this society in every city in the United States. And it's really the culmination of a well-planned, I think, strategy by conservatives to cut back on regulations of business and private property, to do away with the wins and gains we've had in race and gender discrimination and affirmative action. And I think that we're going to see, in terms of policy, which we've already seen, in addition to the Janus case, the use of the First Amendment more and more instead of a vehicle really for protecting the rights of minorities being used to chisel away all of the gains that we've made and being used as a tool for discrimination and even what I would say is roll back the laws that protect individual rights.
Heidi Bogosian, I have a follow-up question for you. There was something that Donald Trump said last night when he announced this nomination. He said that one of the reasons why he picked Brett Kavanaugh was that Kavanaugh would apply the Constitution as it is written. Is that a code word for a right-wing, very conservative interpretation of the Constitution?
I think definitely so. We have seen the originalist theory being used to indicate, you know, it works for a justice who won't answer questions, as none of them will, of course, during this process, the confirmation process, about their stances on political issues. But they will rely on these code words, I think, to signal, you know, adherence to the Constitution, strict application, strict interpretation. Yes. We can expect more conservatism, even with respect to the Second Amendment. We saw that Kavanaugh has held that semi-automatics are protected under the Second Amendment, and that we've had them for a number of years. So history and adherence to the Constitution are being used to signal ultra-conservative views and cutbacks to individual rights.
Yeah, Anoa Changa. Anoa is an attorney. She is also the director of public advocacy and a managing editor of Progressive Army and host of this show, The Way with Anoa. We're also joined, and the person you just listened to was Heidi Bogosian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute. This whole idea, Anoa, of the originalists on the bench, meaning the original interpreting the Constitution the way it was written. I mean, at the time the U.S. Constitution was written, women didn't have the right to vote. This institution of slavery of African people was legal. Only white men with property could vote. Enslaved African people were treated as 3/5 of a human being as part of a compromise between northern, formerly slave and no longer slave states, and the southern states, which were still slave states. On its face, it's such a regressive idea, but it's really just code word, that code language, as if it's going back to something real, something truly American, and not allowing, quote, activist judges to interpret the law. That was because it seemed to me that the political establishment in America used the Supreme Court, one, for the Brown versus the Board of Education, the desegregation of public schools, and Roe v. Wade giving women the right to control their own bodies and choose to have an abortion. Because, and that was a rare instance where the court did something progressive over the last 200 years, but that was only because the legislative branch was too dominated by right-wing racists or misogynists to have been able to pass this necessary kind of legislation. Anyway, go ahead.
I think when you break it down and we look at the makeup of the Supreme Court over the court's existence. I mean, we are looking at, you know, when we look at the last, what, like I said, 50 to 60 years, we had we've had a few periods where we've had, you know, a court that lent a certain way to make sure that certain rights and freedoms were protected. However, when we look at the bulk of the court, particularly, you know, recent decisions, we're talking about, you know, criminal procedure issues involving, you know, police and the scope of searches and seizures and things of that nature. We've had a very conservative framing from even those who might kind of swing votes sometimes, as is noted with Kennedy, right? Like, so there is, when we talk about originalists and we talk about this code language, I mean, to say it's even code is very clear and blatant when folks talk about the original intent. I mean, when you talk about the original intent of the Constitution, you had white male landowners who basically wrote in rights and freedoms for themselves and left everyone else out. Women, poor people, you know, at the time enslaved Africans, and anyone else that would come down the line behind them. So now we've had this false creation of this living document, right, that has been expanded to include the rest of us. But this notion of the quote unquote original intent really is that restrictive in terms of whether or not we're allowed to have access to voting rights, reproductive health, because these things weren't originally intended or conceptualized. So therefore, we shouldn't talk about them, which is absolutely ridiculous. Right. I mean, society has advanced so far from when the Constitution and basically the founding of this country had initially started to argue that, well, originally we weren't supposed to do these things is like really ridiculous. I mean, originally there were only 13 colonies. There were no states either. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that originally existed that no longer exist. And to try to stick to, I mean, it's similar to when we talk about like the good old days or when like Trump supporters say like, we want to go back to the good old days or the way things used to be. I mean, that's that same level of code language that's really signaling that they're trying to go back to a very restrictive time period where we're only protecting the rights, voices, and opportunities for a very small, particularized group of people that subjugates everyone else along in the process.
Heidi, I want to turn to the politics of this for a moment. Back in 2003, when Judge Kavanaugh was nominated by George W. Bush to a seat in the U.S. Court of Appeals here in the District of Columbia, his confirmation hearing was very contentious and the vote was very close. The complaint that the Democrats had was that he was just simply too partisan. He was one of Bush's attorneys during the Florida recount. He had always been closely associated with the National Republican Party, and he barely squeaked through to get this seat on the Court of Appeals. With the Republicans holding the barest of majorities in the Senate, 51-49, and the Democrats apparently galvanized, according to Chuck Schumer, do you think there's a chance to defeat this nomination?
Well, I think there's always a chance. And certainly one of the things we've seen, fortunately, one of the few fortunate developments to come during the Bush administration is that people really in the streets are mobilizing in record numbers in a number of ways, whether it's the Me Too movement, Black Lives Matter, other groups, youth against gun killings. We've had a resurgence of activism, and I think that that has to be looked at as something that can definitely sway certain senators in terms of their votes. But there could be worse people other than Kavanaugh. I think, not to sound too pessimistic, but any person that Trump is going to put forward is going to be an ideological conservative. And, there are a few glimmers of hope, I think, in some of his decisions and opinions. So we never know until someone gets in what happens in terms of whether this individual might serve in the footsteps of Kennedy and be a swing vote on certain cases. So I do think there's a chance that this won't go through, but with this administration, one never knows. I do also want to mention that I think one of the reasons this individual was selected was the possibility of the Mueller investigation at some point reaching the Supreme Court. And given Kavanaugh's experience with the Starr investigation, perhaps Trump felt that he would, and statements that he's made subsequently about a president not being burdened with legal challenges while in office, I'm sure that was a factor as well.
We're speaking with Anoa Chenga and Heidi Bogosian about the new Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh. He's currently on the District of Columbia's Court of Appeals, the second court below the Supreme Court. Again, I want to go back because it seems to me, Anoa, that the Supreme Court is an inherently undemocratic institution. It's got nine rich lawyers, most of them in the past who were serving corporate interests, who are appointed for life and who get to make fundamental decisions about what's law, what's constitutional, and what's not. And when you look through the court's history, and of course, we're talking Brown versus Board of Education, voting rights, Roe v. Wade, some of the progressive ones, but you look at it, the Dred Scott decision of 1857, which basically said that black people in America, free or enslaved people, could not be considered U.S. citizens with full rights. the Buck versus Bell decision, eugenics, by an 8-1 decision allowing the termination of pregnancies for people who were, quote, intellectually inferior. The Korematsu versus United States 1944 allowing Japanese internment camps. Plessy versus Ferguson 1896 that allowed apartheid in America. The civil rights cases of 1883 that struck down the progressive 1875 post-Civil War Civil Rights Act. You can just keep going and going and going. I mean, it's a very, I mean, look, Bush versus Gore, where they stopped counting votes in Florida because they said there would be irreparable harm if Florida votes were continued to count. And that's the only reason George W. Bush, who lost the election by 500,000 votes, became president. Citizens United, where
very, very important
decision. Unlimited funding by any billionaire.
Yeah, corporations are people too.
Yeah, corporations are people. I mean, when you look at the history, it's such an undemocratic, historically, basically right-wing institution. You know, Eugene Debs, the president running on the Socialist Party ticket in 1912, called for the abolition of the U.S. Supreme Court and the abolition of the U.S. Senate, which he called the House of Lords. Anyway, it's not a. It seems to me that while this is an important area where, you know, because the outcomes are so devastating, there has to be another form of governance that is, in fact, more democratic than this.
I think that these are all really serious considerations, and this is a conversation that we need to really be having, particularly when we're seeing just recently, you know, with Kennedy stepping down, retiring, and we're looking at decisions and even the language being used in some of the decisions and recently. I think it was in the NIFLA case, you have Clarence Thomas, you know, drawing these really ridiculous analogies and drafting the decision that was really appealing to the base, which is also something that I saw, you know, in a New York Magazine article about Kavanaugh saying something similar, that this rationalization really has nothing to do with constitutional legal jurisprudence. This is about, you know, this is the same type of, you know, judicial activism they're always complaining about from the supposedly liberal judges on the bench, right? And we see this happening more and increasingly over the last several years, that we have determinations, we have issues being construed so restrictive in a way to actually either prohibit, you know, challenges when the cases are go back down, which is the case with the fake pregnancy clinic case, NIFLA out of California. We see with the language in that case, which, you know, on his way out, Kennedy, you know, basically co-signs that final determination, claiming that mandating that these institutions, you know, explain to people that they're not real doctors is somehow, you know, on our way to fascism. And it's really problematic when we're looking at these people who are treating this as this is some academic exercise, some just games we played about, when we're literally talking about the fate of millions of people across the country, you know, based on the way some of these determinations are made. Now, granted, what I will say is that even though that the Senate itself and the Supreme Court are extremely problematic, I mean, both are extremely, even with the presence of Sotomayor, they are in, I guess, you know, we count Thomas, you know, they're both very deeply entrenched, privileged white institutions, both the Senate and the Supreme Court. And they are the hardest, right, to actually diversify in terms of not just, you know, opinion and thought, but actually background. I mean, think about how many of the justices, if any, have actually a background that is not in criminal prosecution or some other very, you know, narrowly tailored, you know, specific focus and area. So and just thinking about all that and what we need to do move forward, like I it would be interesting to hear from folks if they have any thoughts, just even going back to during FDR's days, thinking about court packing and other strategies like that. But at the same time, we're moving into an era where we have to think about whether or not Kavanaugh is confirmed or not. We need to stop looking at the Supreme Court as the last safeguard in terms of protecting our rights and responsibilities and get back to doing what needs to be done at the state and local level. Because if we can turn around state houses and state legislatures and do what needs to be done in many instances, then we can stop some of these really serious cases from ever needing to be adjudicated at that high level to begin with.
Go ahead, Heidi.
Yes, I agree with that last point especially. I think one of the larger issues is that when we hear nominees promising that they're not going to be swayed by politics. They're going to, in those code words, you know, listen to the strict letter of the Constitution. To me, what that means is they are not going to be really in touch with the pulse of what is going on in the states, in the streets, in our school system, in communities that they are dramatically out of touch with. And, you know, part of the issue that we had and one of our beliefs in the National Lawyers Guild is that, you know, if a law is hurtful and wrong, if it's not working anymore decades or hundreds of years after it was enacted, it needs to be changed. And this is, you know, we're talking about a piece of paper and then adherence to that piece of paper used only to justify their own political viewpoint. So there's a great deal of hypocrisy in these individuals who are saying increasingly that they're not going to be swayed by politics. They are the ones that are being swayed by politics, and it's to serve their small special interest group that unfortunately seems to be getting larger. So I think part of the answer is continued local activism and respect for, you know, local forms of government, where I think they're the leaders are a little more in touch with the will of the people that they are there to serve. And hopefully, you know, continued sensitivity about the need to change a law if it's wrong, if it's harmful.
That's the voice of Heidi Boghossian. You know, the Democratic Party is about to spend tens of millions of dollars with targeted TV ads trying to influence the vote of Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Susan Collins of Maine, Republicans. But, you know, if you took the same amount of money and did what you're suggesting to really build grassroots mass mobilizations of people who want to defend, say, abortion rights rather than TV ads about trying to pressure one or two senators. Public opinion, the majority opinion, is still on the side of women controlling their own bodies and in control of abortion and to have abortion rights as a fundamental right, fundamental human right. That money could be used for mass mobilization. That's the part of the public opinion that has not been marshaled into a powerful movement. We have 30 seconds left.
Clearly, we live in a world of corporate-dominated mass media. The amount of money spent on all of this political advertising, manipulation of public opinion is nothing short of scandalous. I would be in favor of really scaling back the amount of advertising that is even allowed for matters like this and pouring it back into local efforts that I think would put people more in touch with the realities of what's happening. Get them rested from the control of corporate media.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. That was Heidi Boghossian. Heidi is the executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute. She is the former executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. And we were joined from Atlanta, Georgia, by Anoa Changa. Anoa is the director of political advocacy and a managing editor of Progressive Army and the host of the show, The Way with Anoa. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series. It happens every Tuesday. It's called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. We're joined again from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He is a financial policy analyst. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we have a number of big stories. And just again, for our audience, we're looking at the big economic news, but unlike sort of the financial pages of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post or Market Watch on MSNBC, we don't talk simply about what's good for investors or what's coming next in the business cycle. We talk about how the economy impacts us, the people, everyday people, people throughout society. And we try to take the mystique out of the issue of economics and the economy, because this is something that, of course, all of us need to understand and to understand how economic decisions and developments and policy impact our lives. Daniel Sankey, what are we looking at first here?
Well, I think we could start by looking into an article I passed along about tariffs from the Wall Street Journal. Certainly that's been in the news a lot. And, you know, first of all, I think whenever we look at something from the Wall Street Journal, we need to be really aware of who they're representing. And the Wall Street Journal is representing the very, very wealthy, especially from the finance sector. So, you know, you think in the executives of the big banks like JP Morgan Chase or Citibank. So they're going to write with their readers, if you will, in mind. And what they're writing about is how the tariffs that Trump is imposing will actually end up hurting the workers in the various industries that he's supposedly seeking to protect. And it's actually pretty interesting and well-written. And really, it kind of breaks it down very simply, where it talks about how if you're going to impose tariffs on other countries, what that means is it's going to be more expensive for them to sell stuff in the United States. So consequently, they'll make less money. And if they make less money, they're going to also buy less from the United States because they have less money to buy it with. So those industries, and there are many of them, that sell to foreign countries and make a profit here and bring their capital into the U.S. will be hurt because their buyers will start being able to buy less. Consequently, they'll make less money, which will result also in layoffs, more automation, and it will trickle down definitely to hurt the workers because we know that's who usually are targeted once a company starts having trouble. They also go further to talk about how right now, especially, the U.S. dollar is very strong, and all U.S. goods have to be bought in U.S. dollars. So a foreign company, if they want to buy some U.S. goods, have to convert their currency, whatever their local currency is, into U.S. dollars and then buy them. And because U.S. dollars are so expensive right now, they're very strong, it costs those foreign countries a lot more to convert their currency. So they have to spend more of their currency to get a dollar, which in turn raises the price still further.
Let me just ask you then, Daniel. So people in, say, let's say in Japan, they want to buy a U.S. car, or a dealership is buying U.S. cars and they sell U.S. cars to the Japanese consumers. They're taking the yen, the Japanese currency, and they have to convert the yen into dollars to buy those cars. So if the value of the yen is diminished, if the value of the dollar is stronger and the value of the yen is lower, that means it takes more yen to buy the same number of dollars. So the commodities coming from a U.S. car dealer thus cost more, not because a price increase, but just because of the different valuations of those two currencies. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. I mean, you could almost imagine it. If you had to, say, convert your U.S. dollars into yen to buy something you needed, if you can just imagine that world, and it costs, say, five U.S. dollars to buy a yen, but then things change such that it costs now 10 U.S. dollars to buy a yen, effectively the price is doubled, right? It's going to cost you that much more of your dollars to turn it into yen so you can buy something. So this is what's happening, although in reverse, of course, as foreign countries need to move into U.S. dollars. So what this is causing is it's causing foreign countries to have to pay a great deal more to do business with the United States. And while certainly the U.S. imports a great deal, we're probably the largest buyer globally. Well, we are the largest buyer globally. We also export a great deal, and workers depend on those exports for their livelihoods, for the health of the companies that they work for. And ultimately, if it becomes more expensive for these countries to do business with us, the workers will be hurt in the long run by falling profitability.
Daniel, also tell us what this does to mutual funds as well. So many mutual funds in this country where virtually every American with any kind of a 401k has money also fluctuate due to currency changes and due to world events that affect currencies. So what happens to the investments, the retirement accounts especially, that people have?
Yeah, so these foreign currencies definitely impact it. So mutual funds typically invest in a lot of different types of investments, and they have a general strategy, so there's a sort of general sense of what they're going to invest in. When the U.S. dollar increases in value, this can also hurt investments in mutual funds, especially in retirement funds and stuff like that, as foreign investment and foreign capital is harder to attract because they become more expensive to invest in. So that's another way it can also hurt, you know, U.S. workers as well, who depend on things like mutual funds and retirement funds, which are very similar in a lot of ways, to, you know, for their livelihood and to have a, you know, safe and pleasant retirement when they finally finish their work life. So really, we are heavily connected globally, I think is what I'd like your listeners to take away, in that we can't just simply push out other countries from doing business with us without it hurting us as well, and especially hurting those of us who are typically the most vulnerable, the most dependent on these particular industries, where we're pushing out foreign capital that these industries depend on an influx in order to keep going.
I want to move to another topic, and to me, it's not part of our basket of topics, but Daniel, I know you can talk about it. I'm looking at a Wall Street Journal article that came out 13 hours ago, and the headline is "Wage Gains Threaten to Squeeze Retail Industrial Profits." And then the subtitle is "Higher Labor Costs Pose Risk to Some U.S. Companies Already Facing Trade-Related Tensions, Limited Pricing Power." Now, here's the description. And again, because I'm a socialist, I have a particular sort of Marxist approach towards economic issues. And Marx made the point in his writings that there's an irreconcilable contradiction between labor and capital. And I want to explain that so it doesn't sound so...
I'd like to hear an explanation
of
that.
This is why this is like an essential part of socialist economics. But first, I'm going to read the Wall Street Journal, of course. Here's the journal. "Rising wages are beginning to eat into the profits of some U.S. companies. Businesses from dollar stores to hotel operators to fast food chains have warned in recent months that higher labor costs have been a drag on their profits, a potential headwind for the 9-year stock market rally as it struggles for momentum ahead of the second quarter earnings season." So let's unpack that. That means rising wages, the wages that working people depend upon to live, to buy things, to pay rent, put food on the table, pay for their exorbitant healthcare plans. Because those wages are going up, it's a threat to the economic progress. So that's, okay, that's something about this particular economic order called capitalism. But here's the irreconcilable contradiction part. What socialist economics or Marxist economics preach is that the irreconcilable contradiction is that the employer always wants to lower wages, because if wages go up, the money for wages comes from profits. In other words, the profits go to the bosses and the wages go to the workers. And so it goes one way or the other. Now, in the apologists of this particular economic system will say you can't have higher wages because it means the companies will have to increase the price of their commodity. But in fact, they can't increase the price of their commodity arbitrarily because they will be undersold by their competitors. The price is the price. The value is the value. The value is based on an average amount, as socialist economics would say, of socially necessary labor. And that's across the board. You can't arbitrarily say, okay, I'm going to double the price of an automobile because nobody will buy it. They'll buy another automobile. So price is based on value, and value is based on the amount generally of the amount, the average amount of labor that was in that particular commodity. So the irreconcilable contradiction is workers want higher wages and the bosses want higher profits, and it's one or the other. In other words, higher wages come from profits. Anyway, do you see it that way?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. And the Wall Street Journal kind of succinctly puts it into it, although obviously I don't think they'd use the Marxist rhetoric or anything when writing it up. But, you know, the simple first line, "rising wages are beginning to eat in the profits of some U.S. companies," simply means that when workers are paid better or well, that the companies lose money or are seen to be losing money. And I think a lot of it, too, you have to consider, you know, how much is enough money for profits so that you've hit your profits and then the rest can go to workers? Well, of course, there is no limit. Profits need to be limitless and go up and up and up endlessly. And that is, you know, part of the problem. There's many reasons why, you know, some very wealthy elites are upset with Donald Trump and don't support him. But one way is that, you know, Trump is trying to input policy and input controls that will benefit his base. And his base are a lot of retail workers, a lot of factory workers who support him. And a lot of what's really upsetting these very corporate elites is that if his policies are successful and effective and they do increase their wages, and we have seen wage increase this year, far more significant than we've seen in a long time, it's going to hurt their profits because they know where that comes from. We've seen this huge run-up in stock market valuations over the last decade, and this is due to the fact that wages have been kept down. Wages have been kept low, and the argument has always been, oh, well, 2008 happened, and we lost everything, and everyone's just going to have to tighten their belt and accept that they're not going to make as much. And that has worked so far to keep wages down. But the truth is now there's a swinging in the other direction, and these companies are panicking, and we're going to see a lot of air getting let out of the tire as workers are starting to actually benefit from it. But I think if we take a step back and look at the larger picture, which you bring up, Brian, is that this irreconcilable contradiction is untenable. The fact that, you know, a very small group of elites need to make an infinite amount of money should somehow be seen as more appropriate than the vast majority of humanity who need enough money just to live comfortably. You know, it's a very simple thing to decide which of those two sides is more important, which of those two sides. You know, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. It's very simple. And there's no reason why a tiny group of people need to make infinite profit at the cost of other people just not being able to pay rent or buy food.
John, how'd you like my irreconcilable contradiction explanation?
I liked it. I liked it.
You're ready to come to the study group?
I've read Marx and
well, you know, every once in a while, I know where you're going, but every once in a while, the Wall Street Journal actually puts on its front page, Karl Marx was right. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason Karl Marx doesn't go away. I mean, there's lots of interpretations of what Marx meant or what it means in terms of politics or the struggle for political power, all that. But the core explanation of how the capitalist commodity-based market functions has been validated over and over again. It's just the Wall Street Journal doesn't want to accept the political conclusion. But again, I want to stay with this subject if we could. Higher wages are bad for business because it cuts into profits. And thus, if you're the CEO of a company, the only way you can attract capital instead of having capital go to your competitors is to show that you're going to have an improvement in profit or an increase in profit. You have to maximize profit. That means there's always a pressure to lower wages. The reason wages are going up right now is not because of the generosity of the companies. It's because unemployment, the official unemployment, is lower, and so there's less competition between workers. And workers who don't get a higher wage can say, right now, I'll go find a job where I can get higher wages. That's what's causing wages to increase. But with that said, and here's my final part of my rant, if you look at household income, there are 330 million people in the United States. 90% of them, that would be 300 million, 90% of them, the bottom 90%, have an average family income of $34,000. $34,074. That's 90%.
You cannot live on that anywhere in America.
Yeah. So that's the 90%. Then you look at the top 10%, the average income for the household is $312,000. If you look at the top 5%, it's the average family income is $477,000. The average income for the top 1%, that slogan, we are the 99%, well, the 1% average family income every year is $1,363,000. And if you look at the top 0.1%, and those are the real drivers of the American economy, the people who own the corporations, the 0.1%, 0.1%. Their average family income is $6,747,439. So at the bottom 90%, that's 300 million people, $34,000 average family income, the top 0.1%, 6 million family income. Now, that's because of a situation that rewards profits by taking from wages, because guess what? The 90% who are averaging $34,000, they're wage earners. They don't own property. They're not living off of dividends or stocks or investments. They go to work every day. They work for wages. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, I think it's really important to look at that. For me, you know, the reason why socialism makes sense is it's simply a matter of a rational look at the amount of wealth we have. We produce an incredible amount of wealth. Our productive capacities are amazing. You know, hundreds of years ago, people would regularly starve to death, and that was just how it went. You know, you had a bad crop season, and then everybody went hungry. Nowadays, you know, our technology is such that we can produce incredible amounts of food, that we can produce incredible amounts of housing and all sorts of other things as well. So given that we can produce so much wealth, what do we do with it? What's a rational way of using it? What makes sense for humanity? What benefits people the most? What allows us to live the most enriched lives? Right now, the answer has been, well, we should allow a very small group of people to own nearly all of it, and everyone else can fight for just a small amount, which is not enough to sustain them all. That's crazy. That doesn't make sense. You know, if there's five people in the room and five oranges, and one of them says, well, I want four of them, and the rest of you can fight over the last one, and any normal, rational human being would say, well, that's not fair. That doesn't make sense. And yet, that is precisely what we're in. So I think when we look at these different contradictions and within this the current capitalist system we're in, the contradiction between profit-making and wage laborers trying to make a living, trying to just survive, or the contradiction between workers who are U.S. citizens and workers who are immigrants fighting, you know, for scraps over these large corporations, we need to take a step back. And rather than trying to pick a side and say, you know, it's citizens versus immigrants, I'm with the citizens or something, we need to say, can we have a system where these irreconcilable contradictions are reconciled, where there isn't this unnecessary conflict, and where the incredible wealth we use is used in such a way that everyone can benefit from it to live, you know, lives of dignity and goodness? So,
yeah, the reason there's so many poor people is the rich people have all the money. Kind of simple, actually.
It is that simple. It's that simple.
I mean, income and distribution is considered like a crime against nature by American.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and it's not like the capitalist system in the United States is the same in all ways as the capitalist system, say, in Europe, in Denmark, or in Sweden, or mm-hmm. in France,
totally
or in Germany.
Different.
You know, I mean, it's far different. And even though it has the maybe the fundamental same irreconcilable contradiction, the effects of those irreconcilable contradictions have been mitigated by social democratic reforms in Europe that cushion the blow, where in America, there's no cushion. You're just, you know, the bottom 90% are truly suffering. Before we go on to our other stories, I want to stay with this again for another minute or two, because I'm looking at a pattern or a trend about U.S. capitalism. The top 1% share of total U.S. income over the last 100 years. We talked about the 90% average income, 34,000 family income. The top 0.1% average family income of 6.7 million. But when you look at the 1% share of the total U.S. income, in 1975, John, the top 1%, their total income constituted 8.9% of all income. 8.9%. That's the top 1%.
Yes.
That was 40 years ago. Today, that top 1% has 22%, not 8%, but 22% of the entire national wealth. That shows the trend in America as a consequence of Democratic and Republican policies.
Mm-hmm.
Both parties, because the Democrats, especially during the Clinton era in the 1990s, completely embraced these policies. Both parties are responsible for a tripling of income inequality in the last 40 years. And 40 years is not that long of a time. That's the trend. And that trend is not going to change, no matter who wins the presidency in the year 2020, unless there's a radical move by, you know, wage earners and low-income people, the people who are usually considered, you know, talked about in history but not making history. Unless those people actually do make history, these patterns are locked in. They're institutionalized. Anyway, let's finish up on this point, Daniel. You'll get the last word, and then John will go on to some of our other stories.
Yep. Yeah, I think when we talk about that income inequality and how much has changed in just 40 years, we have to realize that this is sort of a snowball rolling down the hill that keeps getting bigger. And when you have this outsized wealth and outsized influence by a tiny group of people, it only grows and becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. It's really important that we start as, you know, workers, as people, to discuss what it means to fight back, what it means to organize. Because right now we're going to see it continuing to move in a direction. We're going to see our United States government moving in a direction where it caters to the needs of this tiny group of people, where it grows more and more out of touch with the vast majority of its citizens, and where more and more people are ground down by these corporate interests. So, you know, before it becomes too late, before we're pushed into some kind of dystopian future where, you know, Amazon controls everything or something like that, we need to really strongly get involved, fight back, and build so that we can have a society where this great wealth is shared in a way that's rational and humane and ethical.
Yeah. Again, the reason there are so many poor people, rich people have all the money. It's that simple in a way. There are 1,500 billionaires worldwide, 1,500 billionaires, and a billion just for people who don't know what a billion is.
Because
It's a thousand millions.
That's
right.
A thousand millions.
There's 1,500 of them. And they have the equivalent wealth of the majority of the population of the world. I mean, that's what we're talking about. Anyway, let's go on with some of the other stories.
Absolutely. One of the articles that was brought up was no poach deals for fast food workers, which was brought up by the New York Times. And right now, certain state regulators are looking into these deals that corporations made with their franchises, where, you know, McDonald's, for example, or Arby's has a franchise system where different franchise owners can kind of trade on their name and open up a business that they sort of own, but also get to have all the, you know, clout from a brand name like Arby's or something like that. And what they said was essentially that it looks like what's happened is the corporations are requiring workers to sign kind of no compete or no poaching clauses secretly. The workers aren't aware that they're agreeing to these terms of service with when they get employed, so that they cannot move within that company. So if you have a position within Arby's and you have the opportunity to take a better role, maybe a promotion, maybe a management role, or maybe just a better paying role doing the same thing in a different store, that you are actually barred from being able to make that transition, that you're not allowed to. And so the states are looking into this because it's obviously, you know, incredibly unjust. And because in many ways, most workers don't even know they've agreed to it. You know, it's like the terms and conditions we click before we sign up for some new online service. Nobody's reading the fine print and nobody's equipped to, you know, make a legal judgment on it. And so this is one example, too, of kind of labor getting ground down on. I think also it's really important that when we look at this is we almost talk about how even in many ways it's anti-capitalist in that all these, you know, companies claim that, well, workers are free and that's America and we can go anywhere we want and take any job we want and compete with each other and we can be entrepreneurs. But really what we can see in these sectors which employ the largest labor forces is that they don't want workers to be able to do that. They don't want workers to be able to better themselves even within their you know, kind of capitalist system. They want workers to be forced and stuck in a particular role. You know, capital and investment can move anywhere. It can move globally. It can go all over the place. Workers, on the other hand, are constrained. And this is just one example of how workers are limited by these industries to keep their wages low and to keep their opportunities non-existent.
Yeah, that would be a good counterpoint for the immigration debate. Let's insist that no foreign capital come to the United States. Right?
Yeah. Right, exactly.
That's what we want.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that? I mean, the dollar would crash amongst other things. But no, of course not. We want capital to flow everywhere. We want as much foreign capital as possible, as much as we can get.
And countries and cities are competing for the attention and the love of these billionaires who we've been talking about, giving them all sorts of tax breaks. Like Amazon is having like multiples, I mean, scores of cities compete against each other to provide tax abatements, taxpayers' money, so that they can set up shop there. And then pay people a wage which is not a living wage. Same with Walmart. I mean, the taxpayer, are actually subsidizing Walmart workers because they're eligible for food stamps in many cases. So Walmart, you know, passes the buck on that. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great thing to talk about. Seattle finally caved and unfortunately will be giving Amazon or trying to tempt Amazon with some significant tax breaks. There was a real fight back, but it looks like it didn't go through. Really the lie is what the politicians will say is, oh, Amazon or these big corporations are going to bring so much economic prosperity, so many jobs, that is worth all this taxpayer money. And the truth is, it won't. What it will bring is highly exploited, low-paid workers who don't have much money to spend anyway. Or, and this is what actually was going to happen in my hometown of Oakland, is Uber was buying a huge office building there and was going to bring in thousands of its workers. And all these little shops around the area were starting to pop up in anticipation of, you know, tech workers buying lunch and groceries and whatever else around there. But the truth is, what they don't realize is tech firms feed all their workers and have huge cafeterias so that workers don't need to leave work and can really be there 24 hours a day, always working on something. There's plenty of snacks and food and beverages and whatever else. So all these restaurants are opening up, not realizing that no worker would leave anyway. They get free food there, and it's usually very good quality food. It's not anything terrible. And their economy is not going to benefit at all. You know, all these different food stores are going to go bust. And the same thing goes for the Amazon situation. So really, why are these, you know, politicians advocating for them? Well, it's because Amazon pays them. They have a lot of money and a lot of lobbyists and a lot of campaign donations, and they're going to give it to these different politicians in exchange for their support. It's really that simple. You know, in other countries it'd be called corruption, but here it's just called, you know, kind of bureaucratic mechanisms or whatever.
Corruption, organized crime. There's different ways that I was fixated on the irreconcilable contradictions of capitalism, peace, and that went on and on. But I'm just looking, John, at the Business Insider. Meet the 11 richest millennials in America who have a combined fortune of $127 billion. Number 10 is Julio Mario Santo Domingo III, $2.4 billion. How did he make his money? How did he earn it? Oh, that was inherited. Anheuser-Busch. The other guy's $3.1 billion, age 27. That's Evan Spiegel. That's Snapchat. Wow. Daniel, what's wrong with this system?
Yeah. Well, what's wrong, and especially you talk about, oh, he inherited it. You know, the idea of kind of democratic capitalism was that, you know, everyone gets a shot to become the rich guy. It's not just about kings and princes anymore. But the truth is, the family you're born into has huge impact over the level of wealth you have. And in many ways, it's much better to be born a Trump or be born, you know, a scion of Anheuser-Busch or whatever than it is to be born anyone else. Because that is part of this huge concentration of wealth.
But then your father would be Donald Trump.
That is true. You would have to deal with that, which is questionable at best. But it's true. It's moving into this sort of feudalistic time where there's these incredibly powerful oligarchs who possess vast amounts of wealth and pass it on to their descendants and maintain these empires. They're called Anheuser-Busch, you know, hundreds of years ago would have been the Holy Roman Empire or something like that. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing that stagnation and concentration of power and wealth.
We're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Daniel Sankey, as we do every Tuesday in this segment called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. We were talking with Daniel Sankey from San Francisco, where he is a financial policy analyst. Stay with us. You're listening to Loud and Clear, and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.